The second case on today's oral argument calendar is case number A19-11, Wenker versus Le Sueur County. Council, I'm sure are familiar with our procedures. Each have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Council for appellant, you may approach and begin. Please identify yourself at the beginning and then proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Joseph Langle, counsel for Le Sueur County. We are here today on the county's motion, an appeal of the county's motion for summary judgment based upon three different immunities. The first immunity is the right-of-way immunity. As you know, the right-of-way immunity applies to county road authorities where their ditches are being used for recreational purposes by snowmobiles. Under this immunity, the county is immune for that usage unless the plaintiff or the respondent here can prove the trespasser exception to that immunity. So the immunity applies unless they can prove the trespasser standard. Under the trespasser standard, they have a few different elements that they must provide proof of, first of which is knowledge of a constant intrusion by trespassers. So not occasional, not every once in a while, constant intrusion. Furthermore, the county must know, or from facts within its knowledge should know, about that constant intrusion. It's not enough that it actually happens, it's that the county has to actually know about it. Your Honors, there was no testimony in this case that by any county employee that they were aware that snowmobilers were using this particular ditch on County Road 21 in this area. This road is way in the western part of Le Sueur County. There's no evidence whatsoever that any county employee was aware of that usage. This is not a ditch where there's a snowmobile trail. There is a trail further north on 99, County Road 99, but there's no snowmobile trail here in this area. If there's no evidence that the county was aware of constant intrusions by snowmobiles, that ends the analysis and the immunity applies.
So your argument really hinges on the word constant. Because obviously, as we all know, the Olmanson accident had occurred. I don't know the record. I don't know that it really goes into what other knowledge the county had. But really, you're arguing that they didn't know of constant usage.
Correct. So Olmanson accident occurred in 2000. Mm-hmm. This accident occurred in 2016, 16 years apart. There is zero evidence in the record that the county was aware of any usage by snowmobiles in between there. There's zero evidence in the record of any usage by snowmobiles before that time. Under the case law, these big gaps over a decade of no knowledge more than suffices to demonstrate the absence of that knowledge and more than suffices to indicate failure by the respondent to prove this point. In order to get around that, respondent argues that, well, the golf course superintendent knew that snowmobiles were using the ditches in that area of County Road 21. The golf course, of course, is on both sides of the road, that they own all the land there. They're there all the time. What they know and what the county knew are two different things. And what was made clear at the district court level was that respondents were trying to impute the golf course superintendent's knowledge to the county. You can't impute knowledge from one party to another party. There's no evidence at all that the golf course superintendent or the golf course board chair or anybody else ever spoke to the county about the snowmobiles going up and down that road. The respondent also argues, well, the ditches can be seen from the road and it's legal a snowmobile in those ditches, to which the response is, so what? That's true of every ditch in the county. That's hundreds and hundreds of miles of roads, hundreds of miles of ditches. That doesn't mean that the ditches are actually being used by snowmobilers. It doesn't mean that it's being used constantly by snowmobilers.
In this case, though, Mr. Langle, was there a dispute, factual dispute, as to whether or not Mr. Wenker was actually in this prohibited area prior to the accident?
Well, they assert there's a factual dispute about.
But there was an expert who testified to that for the plaintiff. Is that right?
There's an expert that made some comment about it. I think the photo that's in the exhibit here destroys the expert's report completely. The photo taken right after the accident, because you can see the trail of this snowmobile. You can see that the, if I may, you can see that the road is on the left and is higher than his track. The ditch continues to go down on the other side of the track. By definition, that's the inslope. He hasn't gone far enough to the right yet.
By definition, what?
That's the inslope. Okay. It's on that part of the ditch that's going down to the bottom. By law, he's got to be at the bottom or on the side.
But the right-of-way is defined by a distance from the center of the road, right? 33 feet from the center?
Yes.
And is there... Did anybody measure, or I mean, with reference to these photographs that we've been given, is there any evidence about where the 33rd foot line is drawn?
With reference to that photograph, no.
Which photograph are you looking at now?
I'm sorry, exhibit. This is exhibit D, or three rather, at the end of the brief.
Exhibit 9, the next page in your addendum, is a little bit clear. I mean, it's a summertime photo, but do we know?
I believe that the culvert, so the concrete portion of the culvert, is within the right-of-way.
And is there anything beyond the culvert that is still in the right-of-way?
Beyond that, standing here today, I cannot tell you where that line is.
Okay.
Was Bergmeier deposed?
The expert?
Yes.
No.
Okay.
No, he was not.
I mean, I recognize, obviously, you're taking issue with his opinion, but his report is in the record, and it, at least at that stage, would you agree, creates a fact issue on that point?
Well, it creates a fact issue as to whether he's on the inslope. I don't think it creates a fact issue as to whether the county was aware of constant intrusions by trespassers. Mm-hmm.
No, I was talking about the inslope issue.
Right. Yeah. Which goes to, but again, the trespasser standard, the way that it's written is we're immune unless we would be liable for trespass as a private person is the way that it's written. So whether, you know, he was actually on the inslope, but still within the right-of-way, but not on the inslope, but still in the right-of-way, it doesn't really matter in terms of the trespass standard. The focus is really on the elements of the Section 335, which deals with constant intrusion and all that business.
Sure.
So.
Go ahead. I wanted to shift topics. Go ahead with you.
Maybe before that, then. Is inslope somehow inserted into the definition of right of way? What's the significance of inslope versus not inslope?
No, they fluctuate. So the right of way is always going to be X feet from the center line.
Right, and the immunity statute says blah 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 within the right of way of a road as defined in section 160.02 subdivision 26. So why does it matter whether he was on the inslope or not on the inslope?
I don't think it does for the purposes of the trespasser standard. What matters is whether he's in the right of way. If he's not in the right of way, then he's just trespassing on the golf course's property because he can't be on their property.
Well, I suppose if he's not in the right of way, then the immunity would not apply, right?
If he's not in the right of way, the immunity wouldn't apply, and it's not on our property, so we wouldn't be liable for it either.
But okay, so but maybe within the fact, for the purposes of this case, is it undisputed that the inslope of the ditch was entirely within the right-of-way?
No, I would not say that that's undisputed.
Okay.
This road, it's hard to see from the photographs, this is a fairly undulating area, and so while the right-of-way always continues parallel with the road, the inslope depth fluctuates a lot, depending upon how deep.
I would imagine. That makes sense.
I mean, in some places, you can't be, if you're not on the inslope, so if you're off of it where you're supposed to be, if you're at the bottom or on the outslope, you're not in the right-of-way anymore. You're on private property, whether it's the golf courses or somebody else's, because the inslopes are so long, because the road is so much higher than everything else. So that, it fluctuates, and then the inslope fluctuates.
Okay. I may have gotten us far afield, and I apologize. But
that's okay. I want to shift to statutory discretionary immunity, if we could, we've got an unusual factual procedural fact, of course, with the Olmanson accident. that decision having been made by this court with respect to the sufficiency of the deliberative process. So I guess my bottom line question for you, Mr. Langel, is what changed pre-Olmanson and post-Olmanson that would demonstrate here that there was the sufficient deliberative process undertaken?
You know, it's an interesting question. And I've been arguing immunity for 20 years. It's an interesting question because of the, within the question was the phrase, what changed?
Well, this court said it wasn't enough.
Right.
Yeah.
But if a county engineer, okay, so Darryl Pettis was county engineer for a long time.
I read his deposition.
Yeah. So, and the policy and practice of the county for many decades was we're not signing these culverts. We're not going to do it. After the Olmanson case, so this litigation went on for 5 years, he testified in this case that given everything that happened in Olmanson, he decided, I'm not changing the policy. That was his call. That's a call that he can make. And he was asked, based on what? Yeah. And his answer was simply, because the policy reasons that have been in place since whenever, 70s, what have you, are still valid. Nothing has changed. The point there is that the deliberative process that he went under after Olmanson, after being subjected to litigation for 5 years, and deciding, you know what, yeah, we got sued for it, and you know we lost an immunity, but I'm not changing my position.
Where do we find his description of that deliberative process?
In his deposition where he talks about, I decided that...
Well, could I just break in? Could I read you one question? This is on page 52. And the plaintiff's counsel asked, when you became Lasura County Highway Engineer, did you make an independent decision to continue to not mark off-road objects, or did you just choose to continue the policy that the county had followed?
It's a great question.
It was a good question, and Mr. Pettis answered, choose to continue the policy the county was already following.
Because if you look at the question, he's asking the same thing twice. Did you choose? He said, yeah, I chose. If I choose to do something, that's a decision.
Isn't that an exercise of judgment?
Yes, absolutely, it's an exercise of judgment.
But is judgment enough under this discretionary exception?
It's certainly enough under official immunity. Under discretionary immunity, what we're looking at here is normally under discretionary immunity, we have some, like, for example, somebody's complaining we didn't put in a turn lane or a stoplight signal or something like that. It's on a five-year plan. We've got all sorts of records of it. When we're talking about signage, this all goes on in the head of the county engineer, every county engineer, because it's his or her decision as to what to do. And they have the authority by law within their budget to spend that money to look at safety factors, to look at maintenance factors. And he talked about all those factors in his deposition. He has the right to make that policy decision. He has the right to change it. He has the right to continue it.
And just because you're running out of time, and I'm struggling with this, because I don't know if I'd been on the panel in Olmanson that I would have gone the way they did. I mean, there was a lot of evidence of, you know, numerosity and cost and risk and, you know, all the maintenance and all these other things. But that panel, in a published decision, said this is not sufficient evidence of a deliberative process. And so I just am wondering, you know, how then we get to the position you would like us to be in.
To which my response is, what evidence could we possibly have when it all happens up here?
Well, it's happening in one person's head.
Right. And which is why I'm saying, even if it's not, doesn't fit the confines of discretionary immunity, it certainly fits the confines of official immunity under the Ireland case. Because under the Ireland case from 1995, The county engineers, highway engineers, have the absolute discretion as to what to do with the signage. They get to decide. It says it right in the Minnesota Manual Uniform Traffic Control Devices. It's their call. Mm-hmm. He made that call. He told the golf course when they asked, no, we're not putting anything up. When he became engineer, he didn't want to make any changes because he felt it was the right decision. It was a decision he stayed with for many, many years. And to this day, he still feels quite adamantly, I might add, that by God, I'm right. This is, putting those delineators up at culverts is a dumb idea.
You may be right, but the question is he immune?
Correct, but that's his discretion. And by law, he has that discretion. And it is an if it's not a high enough level decision, and we don't have enough evidence of that level decision, then it's certainly an operational level decision that is unquestionably within his jurisdiction to make.
Well, now you're running into the Olmanson opinion again, and there it seems it was not so much based on the fulsomeness of the record, but on a question of law. That Olmanson panel saw this as operational, excuse me, planning level, not operational.
And again, we can't look at it as if we're still in Olmanson, right? So we're post-Olmanson. We have to look about his thought process that occurred because of Olmanson. And as indicated in his deposition testimony, he was asked and he answered, I chose not to change anything. The decision not to change anything is just as deserving of immunity as the decision to change something.
But the Olmanson panel decided that it was not deserving of official immunity. Because of the nature of the decision, it seems to me.
Well, and I'm out of time, so okay if I respond?
Oh, yeah, please do. Please.
So, on that point, again, we need to look today at what he did post-Olmanson. I can't look at what happened pre-Olmanson. I need to look at what he did post-Olmanson. And frankly, that decision and the decision in the court below here are not consistent with Ireland. He has the right to do that. There's no question. Nobody even disputes the fact that he's got the right to do it. County engineers do this on an almost daily basis. They don't make nice records of it for lawyers, but they do this all the time. And the court has acknowledged that they have the discretion to do it. And to the extent that what they're doing is in furtherance of an approved or accepted policy, and what you're doing is in fact attacking the policy, and that policy is based upon discretionary decisions, again, that's protected by official immunity.
If you have more questions.
I do not. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Langle. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Dan Bellig. I represent the plaintiff's respondents in this matter. I think what I'll do is try to track the discussion from the preceding argument, and that started with highway right-of-way immunity. Principally, the discussion was focused on the knowledge of constant use standard. Where I want to start, though, is not with the facts. I want to start with the legal standard, because I think the briefs are starting to draw out potentially a legal question about what is the standard? Is it actual or imputed knowledge that applies in respect to constant intrusion? And the case that controls here is out of the Minnesota Supreme Court, and that's Green Glow Turf. Okay, that's cited in our brief. That's also cited in the appellant's principal brief. And that case is quite clear that the question is whether the county knew or ought reasonably to be known of the constant intrusions. That's an imputed or constructive knowledge standard. The county's reply brief in particular here seems to be pressing quite hard for an actual knowledge standard, but Green Glow Turf says that's not the case. Green Glow Turf also uses language about whether the intrusion was, quote, readily foreseeable. Again, that's sort of an imputed knowledge standard rather than an actual knowledge standard.
Why ought they have known here?
Excuse me?
So why ought they have known here?
Sure. First of all, snowmobilers regularly use the ditches throughout the county. They know that. Now they've said there's lots of roadways and all that, but that's the starting baseline. The other one is that use of that is lawful. And one of the facts, and I don't think you have a citation to this because it's kind of taken for granted in the briefs, but one of the facts here is that the county has maintained this highway since 1961. They are responsible for its maintenance, inspection, repair, and snow plowing. This is in the Pettis deposition, index 36 at 128 and index 36 at 113. So they're out there doing this stuff, especially during the winter with snow plowing. So if you take that and you add that to the fact that this is primarily the snowmobiler's trail, and you put those two together, all right, and then you look at the satellite photo that was provided in our brief, you'll see that there, the ditch is readily visible, it's not obstructed from the roadway. So you can infer that the county, who's out there all the time doing maintenance, repair, snow plowing, and all of that, is seeing the tracks of these snowmobilers who readily use this trail. On top of that, you have the Olmanson case, and on top of that, you have their immunity arguments. What's one of the immunity arguments they're making that translates back into this constant knowledge? Well, this is the Rickman affidavit. This is index 36 at 167. And the Rickman affidavit tries to put forward this immunity claim that, well, we consider all of these things with respect to ditches, and it involves considering whether snowmobilers are going to hit these additional markers. Well, why would you be considering these things if you weren't aware of intrusion into your ditches? So by the time you add all of this up, the question is, can a jury reasonably infer? All right, the argument we hear in the language that's used in the appellant's brief is, we did not establish, all right? But that's not the standard here. Remember the posture that we're in. We're on a denial of summary judgment, okay? We don't have to establish as definitive proof that this is what they knew. We're not the moving party. All we have to establish is that there's a sufficient trail of facts for the jury to make the inference that someone from the county since 1961, given all these things, has seen the tracks from snowmobilers who primarily use this as a trail. The other point I want to make, and I think it gets a little muddled in the briefs, is, again, the procedural issue is important here. Because on summary judgment, the county as the movant must first establish its entitlement to judgment. And this is critical, okay? The Zacharias case, it's a Minnesota case, 506 Northwest 2D 313 at 320, talks about how the movement in immunity cases must first establish immunity. In other words, it's on the county to establish first that these elements are met. Then the burden shifts to us as the respondent or the non-moving party to produce evidence that creates a conflict. Here's what's interesting. The county doesn't actually say in record evidence, and therefore fails to meet their burden of proof as the movement. They do not actually say, we were not aware. There's argument in their brief about that, but there's actually no citation into the record. And why is that? Because they were aware. They maintained the road. They see how the ditch is used. They're aware of Olmanson. They had people. The golf course came back after Olmanson, according to them, and said, this is the Keeneland affidavit, said, we want some signage out there. And the county said no. Well,
so your argument is that the county first needs to come forward with evidence that would disprove an element of the trespass exception?
That's what I believe Zacharias stands for.
Only
yes.
When they do that, then you have the you assume the burden of proving the trespass exception.
Not proving, but showing facts that a jury could
right.
could use to find in our favor, correct. Okay. So I think those procedural things are key. One, we need to establish that this is an imputed knowledge standard, not an actual knowledge standard. Two, that they didn't satisfy their initial burden. Even if we did, we rebutted it. And three, it's not a direct evidence standard, all right? The jury is allowed to make reasonable inferences based on all of this litany of facts, their maintenance, the constant usage testified to by others, the open view of the roadway, the fact the county constantly maintains it, the prior accident, having been asked for a signage, according to the Keeneland affidavit. These are all things that the jury can lump together and say, yeah, the county not only should have known, but the county probably had actual knowledge too. And that's why we think summary judgment denial was appropriate on that particular issue.
You've used the word imputed. You've also used the word constructive. I'm not sure if you meant them to be synonymous. But, I mean, are either of those words used in the applicable case law?
Well, the language from Greenglow Turf is what's going to control here. So let me just find that so I'm accurate with it. It says in Greenglow Turf, the state is liable for bodily injury caused to persons whose presence within or outside of the recreational area, in this case that would be the right-of-way, is known or ought reasonably to be known. So to me that's constructive standard. Ought reasonably to be known would also sort of get that imputed. You've got your roadway people out there who are potentially seeing these things, that knowledge is
constructive knowledge makes sense to me that, that's what it's describing. I'm not sure if I would agree that the term imputed knowledge is appropriate there. I mean, I think imputed knowledge is reflects a legal presumption that somebody is deemed to be aware, whether they are or not, whether they should be or not. You know, a person in an organization, an agent of a principal, if the agent becomes aware, we impute the knowledge to the principal, for example.
Sure. Whatever the magic language is, and maybe I'm muddling it, but whatever the magic language is.
Well, it could be meaningful. But, I mean, I guess if one employee of the county sees a snowmobile track on one occasion, I'm just not sure what the significance of that fact would be. But.
Well, again, the evidence here is not that one snowmobile used this. The evidence was that this was primarily their trail. That fact's actually undisputed, by the way.
That was the testimony of a golf course employee.
Yes,
right?
Mr. Fossen, I believe. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he knows, it's readily apparent, and he's out there. And the county's out there, too, maintaining and snow plowing this roadway for many, many years. In fact, when Mr. Fossen, if I recall the record accurately, when he testifies that this is primarily their trail, it's not just it was primarily their trail for 1 year. This is going back to even before Olmanson. So over how many years does the county have the opportunity, or should they know that this is what's going on?
Doesn't the statute require evidence not just that snowmobilers use trails generally throughout all the ditches, but in this particular spot? Do you agree with that? That's the issue.
Correct. So
because it says possessor of land knows or should know that trespassers constantly intrude upon a limited area of the land.
Right. So I would agree that if we were saying, well, there was constant intrusion 2 miles away, that would be difficult to say they should have known here. But the undisputed testimony is that this particular ditch from Mr. Fossen, the golf course superintendent, I believe, was that this was primarily their trail.
Okay, then what about, did the county know that, or should the county have known that?
Yes, because they have been maintaining and snow plowing this roadway since 1961, and this primary use of their trail has been occurring since before Olmanson. So this is back before, we're almost, 20 years plus now that they've snowmobilers have been on this trail quite often, according to Fossen. In fact, they even stopped, there's some testimony, I don't know if it's in a footnote or from Fossen, but the golf course itself had been putting up signs right on the border of their thing, like, hey, stay off the course. And they quit doing it because the traffic was so, no one listened to it, and it was so common that they just stopped doing it. It was pointless. These facts are undisputed. And how the county could not be aware of that after all this maintenance, or at least a jury being able to infer that they should have been aware from it over all these years, to me, that's where the fact issue is.
But the county could make a policy decision, even knowing there's traffic in this area, that putting up warning signs might increase hazards. I mean, there are a lot of things that might factor in their decision to mark or not mark.
Okay, so shifting out of the restatement issue into the immunity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they could do that, but the problem they have is the moving party again on summary judgment, and is the party who benefits from immunity is whether they can prove it, all right? So they have that initial burden to prove discretionary immunity. Olmanson said you came in with, conclusory affidavits that didn't really, they talked about theoretical things you would consider that you could, and this is my editorial here, that you could make up after the fact as relevant considerations. But Olmanson demands, hey, if you're going to be the party that gets this immunity, this is very special. If you're going to be someone who gets this, you've got to establish this with some definitive evidence about the process itself. There's no evidence of process here, right? What we're hearing is, well, Mr. Pettis went through this in his head. Well, then you would lose a discretionary immunity case every time. Olmanson requires more. Did he actually sit down? What did he look at? What statistics were analyzed? How long did this take? Who did he consult? There's not that evidence here. The issue, though, and I think I want to shortcut this immunity thing because it's a really difficult issue, especially when you have different sorts of immunity being claimed, is whether the nature of the decision involved really rises, whether it's in the policymaking level or the ministerial level, whether it even rises to something that's protected. And so look at what happened here. Look at the testimony. Olmanson recognized this too. It wasn't just that they didn't come forward with evidence, but there was evidence in the record that the policy was, if someone asks for a sign, we'll give it to them. Well, that's not exercising policymaking level where you're weighing social, economic, and political factors. That's you're just abiding someone's request. And that's same at the ministerial level. There's no professional judgment being executed there. It's just, oh, well, you want a sign, we'll put it there. And that was Pettis's testimony from the prior case. Now look what happens after Wenker. Look at the process that was used after Wenker's accident. So the golf course sends some of this sort of strange letter, right? They're kind of, you know, hesitating on how to phrase it, but they ask, you know, what guidance, if any, is to signage or not, or something like that. I don't remember the precise language, but it's kind of, it's a little bit goofy. And so the county comes out, and they agree to put a sign. Well, what was the deliberative process that was used there? This Teagues, the new guy, comes out and goes, okay. That kind of decision-making is not what is entitled to immunity. So look at the Williamson and Terwilliger cases from the Supreme Court. I mean, we're not even giving doctors who have life and death decision-making problems, okay, major, major decisions involving major levels of professional discretion. We're not giving them immunity. What they needed to show to get entitled to at least official immunity here was some sort of emergency that required split-second decision-making under the official immunity standard. That's not what happened here. He came out and said, okay. And that's consistent with Pettis's prior testimony about they would do it if someone requested it. Well, if they'll do it if someone requests it, what are the social economic factors? They're not there. They could be there. And that's what they're arguing. And that's what they're trying to do with their rehabilitative affidavits, is that these could be considerations. But when you look at the contradictory evidence and the facts on the ground, that's not what's really going on here. Or at least there's a dispute for the jury to decide.
Well, just to be clear, when you talk about rehabilitative affidavits, I mean, the affidavits that were in the record for Olmanson were in the record, correct?
Correct.
I mean, Richmond and Sandvik and these other individuals who provided affidavits.
Right. In reference to here specifically, so you had to ask for some page numbers if I can give them to you.
Sure. Is that all right?
You had asked for some page numbers on what things were factored by Pettis when he chose to continue this established practice. So index 36 at 124 to 128, talk about all of the factors that he didn't consider.
Is this part of his deposition?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And I just have the index number for you on that.
Okay.
Index 36 at 124 to 128. And I see that I'm out of time.
Right. There may be some additional questions. I have one. Go ahead. Maybe you want to complete this.
No, I'm fine.
Are you making the argument that, well, am I correct that I've seen an affidavit of Mr. Pettis, I believe it was dated June of, well, I can't remember. Did the affidavit come after the deposition?
There is, I believe, a motion related affidavit that comes after the deposition.
And are you arguing that the affidavit that was executed after the deposition is inconsistent with the deposition?
I am arguing that it is inconsistent with his prior deposition testimony in Olmanson, which was under oath as well, that they had this practice, so to speak, of giving a sign out whenever it's requested. And to the extent it's arguing that various things were considered, if you go into his current deposition and compare that to, well, Olmanson didn't really cause me to do anything, I didn't consider these other factors, to the extent that that's trying to, you know, change that, it's inconsistent, it's a fact issue.
Well, okay, so that's my question, I guess. Is you say to the extent that, but does that exist? I mean, is there a part of his affidavit that you're telling us we should disregard because it's contradicted by his prior deposition testimony?
I think you should disregard the entire thing because I think it's all theoretical. This is what we could consider. These are factors that may have gone into the policy. But if you look at his deposition, what the depositions say historically is that no one really knows how this decision was made. He specifically testifies in his current deposition that there were no further social or political considerations that he was ever aware of, ever going back. So what I think, if you look at his affidavits in a whole, is they're trying to fill in this gap of evidence, but the problem is he's been deposed, and they say there's no history to this established practice.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Belli. Mr. Langle, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will just state that opposing counsel's rendition of the facts of the record are not accurate. In his affidavit, which is entirely consistent with his deposition testimony, he talks about the fact that, after Olmanson, and this is the problem in this whole analysis by respondents, they keep going back to Olmanson like they just want to use this as some cure-all for this case. There's a lot of years between Olmanson and Wenker, a lot of years. And Pettis's point in his affidavit was, I litigated Olmanson. We talked about this. He even says it in an affidavit. We talked about this in the county. Should we change this stuff? And the answer is no. We're not going to change it. We have the right to change it. We have the authority to change it. We're not going to change it. That's post-Olmanson. Olmanson doesn't help them when they make decisions after Olmanson that are subject to immunity. And official immunity absolutely does not require an emergency situation. That is patently false. The Ireland case was a county engineer, 1995. There are multiple official immunity cases where emergency situations were not involved. And in terms of cases where doctors were not given immunity, when you look at ministerial exceptions to official immunity, it's because they are required to follow a policy. That's not what's happening here. This is the county engineer deciding what to do and deciding that the practice and conduct over the last 30, 40 years is appropriate, and this is why it's appropriate. And he talked about his deposition, boom, boom, boom. This is why it's appropriate, and we're not going to change it, even though we could. That kind of decision absolutely is subject to immunity. And in terms of the right-of-way immunity standard, there is a massive misstatement as to the burden here. While generally speaking, the moving party in an immunity case has to demonstrate immunity, in a right-of-way immunity, that burden, according to the courts, flips to the plaintiff to determine that the exception, the trespass exception, does not apply. That's their burden. It is not our burden. And we cited the case law in our brief to that effect.
Is there a burden shifting? Do you have an initial burden before the plaintiff has that burden?
There's very little burden shifting in the right-of-way immunity because of the way it's phrased. In the right-of-way immunity, as long as we establish that, we've got a right-of-way and they're using a vehicle that satisfies the statutory definition of a recreational vehicle, it's a snowmobile, then we establish that right-of-way immunity applies. In this case, none of that is even disputed. So once that is finished, then we get into the exception, and that's when the burden shifts to the respondent to demonstrate that the exception is satisfied. This whole idea about we have hundreds of miles of ditches, and we can just infer that because snowmobiles use some of these ditches, that a jury should be allowed to infer or impute or whatever word you want to use that we had knowledge of constant intrusions is a complete misstatement of the burden here. If that's the case, if that's really what we're talking about, then the right-of-way immunity is dead. Just throw it out. It has no usefulness whatsoever. They have to, and look at the cases that talk all over the country. We cite cases all over the place about restatement section 335 and what that means. What does that trespass standard really mean? It talks about, these cases talk about the constant intrusions in the vicinity, in this area, not 40 miles on the other end of the county, not generalized knowledge about stuff. There's even a case, and I can't remember which one it was, talking about there's a trail on the other side of a line. This person came off the trail and got injured on this person's property, and the court said there's no knowledge of an intrusion on this property. There's knowledge of people using an unofficial, informal trail over there, but not over here. That's not good enough. There has to be knowledge of constant intrusions on this property in this location. And there isn't, except by the golf course. The golf course knew. And just so we're clear on the language of the golf course superintendent or whoever that was, the old deposition was, because he keeps using the phrase, it's primarily their trail. The deposition was, did you ever notice snowmobilers generally going along County Road 21 on the shoulder or in the ditch? Mainly it was in the ditch. That's not an uncommon area for snowmobilers, is it? No. Pretty restricted in the places they can ride, so ditch is primarily their trail. That's the context for the phrase primarily their trail. The ditch is primarily their trail. Not this ditch. Ditches in general are where they ride, which is true.
When he says restricted and where they can go, what did he mean by that?
You can't drive on the road. You can't drive on the inslope. You can't drive on private property. If you own a snowmobile, your options as to where you can go play in the snow are limited. You can't go on state highways either. You can go on county roads, township roads, in the ditches, not on the inslope. So in that respect, the language is correct, but it doesn't mean what he's claiming it means, that it was primarily their trail in this location. That wasn't the testimony at all. But more importantly, there's nothing in the record that shows that any knowledge about snowmobiling in this location was ever transferred to the county, and you can't impute it. You can't just say, well, at trial, if we're given the chance, we will get somebody on the stand who will give us testimony that we want. This was a summary judgment motion. We made an argument. They are required to put facts on the table that dispute that argument and create an issue of fact. They did not do so.
Thank you, Mr. Langle.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is well argued. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days. With the conclusion of that oral argument, the court is now in recess.
All rise.